It is kind of cool. I can see my email now.
Yeah, I think.
Yeah, he actually goes like on a week.
February 13th, General Employees Retirement System Board meeting. Do we have any public comments? Okay. Presentations, Wellington Portfolio Review.
They here, do you?
Yeah, I can go get them. Just a couple words before they come in. You can look at their returns in the book. They'll be bringing a book of their own. And they are a large cap growth manager of yours, so you have two large cap managers. They're one of them. The more recent performance has been challenging, which has affected their longer term performance. So, so we'll just get them in here and...
What page are they on? What page are you?
Page 32, you can see their performance. And then if you want a more detail just on them, which shows their holdings as of December, it's page 48.
Thanks, ma'am.
Page 48 through 54 is all their sections. So you can look at their holdings, their best and worst stocks on pages 53 and 54. Okay, any other questions? We'll go get them. We'll have you right here.
Great.
Should I shut this door a little bit? You can shut it, sir. How's everyone this morning?
Good morning.
Thanks for having us.
I brought donuts there for a second.
Actually, you guys have the donuts.
Yeah, I saw Dunkin' Donuts.
I know, right?
Well, I have some materials if you need them.
Okay.
Maybe I'll just give you a couple, just in case. Matt, can you, thank you. Let me know if you need additional copies of the rough money. So thank you so much for inviting us to speak with you today. So we're traveling from Boston, which, as you may have seen on the news this morning, is getting dumped with more and more snow. So we're really happy to be in sunny Florida. And we're actually praying.
Even if it rains a little bit, we're still
yeah. We're actually praying that our flight this afternoon gets canceled. And we left. Just by way of introduction, my name is Beth Catino. I'm the relationship manager that's responsible for the Ocala relationship with Wellington. And I'm joined by my colleague, Matt McKenna, who works within our equity product management group. And he is the portfolio specialist, works very closely on the diversified growth approach. He's responsible for the risk development and oversight, business oversight of the strategy, and works day to day with Paul Marcant, who is the portfolio manager of the strategy. So what I thought I'd do, actually, let me just check in on time. Do we have 30 minutes, or should we?
Yeah, we have 30 minutes.
30 minutes.
So we like to stay between 20 and 25 so we can have questions.
Great. So I will speak very briefly, and then I'll turn it over to Matt to give an in-depth review of the portfolio. So again, thank you for inviting us to talk about diversified growth. We're also very pleased to see our relationship expand last year with the funding of opportunistic investments, so thank you for your business. On the diversified growth strategy, we recognize that performance has been challenging, and we're prepared to talk through what worked, what didn't over the last year, and Paul and team's outlook for the future. Before turning it to Matt, I thought we would just spend a few minutes on page one, which is an update on Wellington as a firm.
And just as a reminder, there are three distinctions on futures that I believe set us apart as an investment manager in the space. The first is our ownership model. So as you may recall, we are structured as a private partnership. At the end of last year, we had just over 160 partners of the firm, and they're all active in the business. Being private really allows us to take that long-term view and align our interests with those of our clients. It's not beholden to conflicting performance or answering to shareholders on short-term performance or any short-term objectives, which is terrific. Our ownership model really allows us to attract and retain what we believe to be world-class investment talent. And as a result of that, those that come to Wellington stay at Wellington for their career. I'm an example of that. I'm not on the investment side, but I am certainly an example of that. I've been with the firm almost 17 years. And the reason why I mention this is it keeps our investment turnover low. So the 3- and 5-year investment turnover number is right around 5-6%. So that's low for the industry. As a reminder for the diversified growth strategy, Paul Marcand, who is the lead portfolio manager, is a partner of the firm, and he has been for a number of years. The second reminder I'd like to highlight is our singular business model. So our business model is entirely focused on investment management. That is our only business. We have no distractions, no competing priorities. And we continue to be diversified across asset classes, across client geographies, and types of clients that we work with. At the end of last year, we had $979 billion in client assets under management. And the asset class breakdown was 40% in equities, 40% fixed, and the remainder in multi-asset strategies. So lastly, I'll mention our investment model and our culture, which are very much tied together. We have no chief investment officer at Wellington. And why is that important? It's important because we empower our investment teams to make decisions on behalf of client portfolios. They have their own investment philosophy. And collaboration, this really drives the collaboration because each investment team talks to one another and they draw on the expertise of our central research team. And Matt can talk a little bit about how Paul and the team leverage other content and views at the firm. Lastly, I will just mention from a risk perspective, the firm's depth and breadth of resources really allow for independent risk oversight and analysis at the firm. And so I know you asked us to talk a little bit about risk in the portfolio and how we manage risk. And so we can talk about some of the independent reviews that the firm provides for Paul and the team. Are there any questions on the firm before I hand it over to Matt to give a refresher on the strategy and talk about results?
Great. Thanks for that, Beth. And I will say that she had no voice this morning because she was sick, so actually not that good. I was pretty impressed. But anyway, so why don't we, in terms of the diversified growth approach, why don't we go ahead and start on page 3 in the materials? And also, please don't hesitate to interrupt with questions at all along the way. You know, if you want to have, it doesn't matter what the question is, feel free to interrupt anywhere. So on slide 3, just because it's been a while since we've spoken to you about the approach, the last time we were in front of you was 2012, so I thought it would make sense to talk a little bit about what we do, a bit of a refresh in terms of the philosophy and process, and a few points about the team as well before we start talking a little bit about performance, and obviously I'll spend a few minutes talking about risk management as well, as that was something that we were specifically asked to address down here. So on slide 3, we talk a little bit about an overview of the approach, and so really what we're trying to do in this portfolio is we're looking to build a portfolio, a diversified portfolio that looks specifically at putting stocks in the portfolio that have three particular components. So we're looking for growth, quality, and valuation. And really trying to build a portfolio around those three key components is really what drives all the decision making that we do in this portfolio. And then at the bottom, you can see we have this last bullet that talks about risk analysis. So we do spend a lot of time sort of post-trade, after the fact, looking at the risk exposures of the portfolio to make sure that they fall in line with what our expectations are, what the portfolio should look like, and what we've told our clients that it should look like. And I'll talk a little bit more about risk management on a following slide. On slide four, this is our investment team and resources. And so at the top, you see Paul Marcan. So Paul is the sole decision maker here on this portfolio. He's been at the firm for quite some time. He's been investing for over three decades. So he has a wealth of experience investing through a lot of different types of market environments. He's supported by the two individuals you see below him. Those are team analysts, so they help him make decisions and they help frame the decisions that you're making, that he's making on behalf of your portfolio. And then last but not least, I'm here at the lonely at the bottom here. I, as Beth had mentioned, I'm the team's dedicated product manager, so I do think a lot about risk, about business issues, and I also speak to clients and prospects on their behalf. The only change that we've had on this team in the last 4 years is this gentleman by the name of Clark Shields here, who's just one spot above me. He actually joined our team in early, sort of the spring of 2015. He joined us from T. Rowe Price with a wealth of experience in terms of growth investing. He has, you know, he came to us with specifically expertise investing in business services type companies. But we hired him because we recognized that he has the talent to expand that coverage and do a lot more. So since he's joined us in the last year and a half, he's been able to cover a lot more of the industrials, financials, and then some certain components of information technology. So Clark's been a great contribution to the team so far, and we're really happy with how the team is set up. Beth mentioned a few points about how we leverage the broad resources of the firm. So we are a very big investment shop, and we have a lot of resources that Paul and the team can benefit from and utilize. Below me, we have what we call global industry analysts. We have 55 GIAs, and they're specifically focused on a individual industry within the market. So, for example, biotechnology or pharmaceuticals or different or consumer discretionary. And so the team really utilizes them to get that extra, you know, industry perspective, to know the companies well, to know the industries really well. And so they really leverage them. They have their own, our team has their own process and philosophy, so we invest on that behalf, but they help us with additional context. If you want to flip to slide five, which is the next page. Again, this is just a quick snapshot of a nice graphical representation of how we build the portfolio again. So you can see the different components that I mentioned on that prior page. So we're focused on growth, quality, and valuation. And you can see the different metrics that we think about for each of these different buckets of the portfolio. And what's unique about this is that if you see that dark dot in the middle of the slide, that is a very small subset of the universe. So it's really hard to find stocks that have all three of those components. The market's just really not that inefficient to find attractive growth characteristics, trading at an attractive valuation, and also has high quality characteristics. It's really hard to find those types of companies. So what we try to do is we're looking for individual stocks that have a combination of those different characteristics. So they might have growth and quality, or they might have quality and valuation. So they might have two out of the three metrics. And we view the portfolio in aggregate as having better growth, more attractive valuation, and better quality than the benchmark. And what I will stress is that this is not a portfolio that we invest in aggressive growth stocks. It's just not what Paul does. The team is very valuation conscious, and so that has been something that certainly hurt our performance over the last couple of years because the economic growth in the U.S. has been very low. So in order to outperform the benchmark, there's been a premium that's been placed on the most aggressive growth stocks in the universe. And so it's really, given Paul's valuation sensitivity and focus, it's been hard to find stocks that can keep up with that, because you do often have to pay a big premium to buy those growth stocks. So it has been a bit of a challenge for us. Unless there's any questions, we can flip ahead to slide six.
Can you talk a little bit about dividend-paying stocks? I know they've been run up in the market over the last couple of years. And has that affected how you've managed the portfolio? And is that something you take into consideration?
Yeah, so dividend yield isn't an explicit thing that Paul is looking for when he's building the portfolio. There's definitely been, there's actually a slide that we have in the back of the deck that I can show that, specifically shows the performance of the S&P 500 and then the different stocks that have done particularly well over the last 5 or 6 years. And so the lowest volatility, the highest dividend yielding stocks have been the best performing areas of the market. And there's a couple of probably more structural reasons for that, just given that interest rates have been so low, so the bond proxies have been, an area that people have focused on. And then also because there's been so much macro uncertainty that people have been really, I would say, crowding into these more kind of, safe positions. And so it's definitely been a headwind for us. But it's not something that we explicitly focus on. We don't have to, a company doesn't have to pay a dividend for us to own it. And so we do have companies that don't pay dividends. But So I think in terms of yield, it's a component, but it's not a driver of what we do for decision making, but it's definitely been a headwind.
Do you think that's going to continue in the future?
Or do you think
as maybe interest rates go up, that will not be as big of a case, or do you think it's going to continue?
So I do think that the last 5 or 6 years, given the run-up in those stocks, valuations are really not attractive in that area of the market. So I think, you know, the one challenge, though, is that those companies have typically maintained a pretty steady valuation premium over the years, but they have had a tremendous run over the last 5 or 6 years. So I don't know if they're going to keep up as well as some of the other areas in the market. So if you think about, you know, I'll talk about this a little bit in outlook and positioning, but we do think that there's more attractive opportunities in areas like energy, industrials, more cyclical growth areas of the market that have been depressed and haven't performed as well just given the economic environment. But as things have changed a bit in D.C. and there's been a little bit more of a potential emphasis on less regulation and potentially lower taxes, we think that there's other areas of the market that could do better. But again, I don't have a crystal ball.
Yeah. Thank you.
So on slide 6 is a couple of quick points about portfolio construction. So this team does build all their own individual models for all the stocks that are owned in the portfolio, and they have a really unique database that actually pulls all the financial stats into a sort of a bigger database, and they can rank the stocks that they're looking at based on all the metrics that they find attractive. And so what they're trying to do is find the right combination of companies that actually makes the growth a little bit better, the valuation a little bit more attractive, and quality a little bit more attractive than the benchmark. And then last but not least, we do spend a lot of time controlling for risk factors. I do that with Paul. Paul does that on his own, so we do have a lot of backstop. But the next page actually goes into a little bit more on risk management that I can talk to at a little bit more length. And so on this slide, you can see, so at Wellington, we do have a lot of resources. So we are a big firm, as Beth mentioned. We have a lot of risk apparatus, and all the individuals that you see around this circle are all involved in one way or the other in risk oversight and management. And so, but from our perspective, it really always starts with the portfolio manager. So he's really the key participant when it comes to risk management. So really it's all about, and you know, we state this in the middle of this circle about the philosophy and process. And so him following his philosophy and process is really the most important component of what he does. But then we have all these other individuals that are around the PM that do support him in terms of risk oversight and management. And so, you know, just from my perspective, my role in product management, I'm in the top upper right-hand corner. I do a lot more of the day-to-day risk management oversight, and so I'm sitting down with Paul on a regular basis, kind of reviewing the risk exposures, what the portfolio looks like from the top down, a lot of different things that he might not be focused on a day-to-day basis. And I do formally sit down with Paul every 3 months or 4 times a year to do a formal risk overview of the portfolio, just to make sure that there's no unintended risk exposures in the portfolio. So he does tend to not own the most aggressive growth type stocks in the benchmark. And so if I am reviewing the exposures in the portfolio and I tend to see, you know, if I see growth being a much bigger exposure than it's been in the past, that to me is a red flag, and I would ask Paul to elaborate on why that's happening. So really I have a very, a much more hands-on day-to-day interaction with Paul, but you see all the other components around this circle. These are more like semi-annual type reviews for risk, and so it really is a very robust risk apparatus at the firm. So on slide 8, obviously I'm sure you're all probably very eager to talk about performance. And you can see on slide 8, this shows the annualized performance over the last, you know, 5 years annually and then since inception. And obviously, you know, it's, you know, just to address, the performance has obviously not met expectations. We have not met our investment objective for you, you know, over the last 5 or 6 years, and that, you know, has certainly been a challenge for us. We haven't met it for you or your participants, and you know, we're disappointed in the performance of the portfolio, as I'm sure you are as well. But you know, the team is working as hard as they ever have to try and to turn things around. We are, you know, we continue to be positive about the outlook for the portfolio, but there has been certainly some headwinds, I think, over the last couple of years that have, you know, gotten in the way of us meeting our objective. There has been some macroeconomic headwinds, but that's not, you know, not to sit here and say that's the only reasons that we want to perform. There's definitely been, you know, there's a human element to portfolio management, and there's certainly been some mistakes made in the portfolio. That's just, it's the nature of investing. You tend to make, as long as you're making fewer mistakes than you're making positive decisions, then you tend to outperform. But we've had, you know, some headwinds over the years. What's been particularly disappointing is that after a benchmark positive calendar year 2015, where we had broad participation across the portfolio. We had calendar year 2016, where we underperformed the benchmark by about 300 basis points. So that's been a pretty difficult environment for us. I will point, what's interesting is that even though we did underperform by 300 basis points, we actually finished about second quartile in the large cap growth category. So, certainly under active management and large cap categories have been challenged the last couple of years. And so, for example, in 2016, I think 85% of large cap growth managers underperformed their benchmark for a variety of different reasons. So it's certainly been difficult. We've spent some time thinking through the philosophy and process. We continue to be committed to what we do, and Paul's been investing in this manner for the last 30 years, and he thinks that he's very convicted in how he does it, and we hope that the portfolio turns around.
Can you talk a little bit more about passive management and why that has been, was so strong in 2016 versus active managers?
You mean just the flows in general?
Yeah, just the flows in general and sort of, I've been to a lot of client meetings. Uh-huh. I've heard a lot of managers just really talk about the fundamentals of a portfolio, and then the fact that passive is just investing in the whole thing, and that quality type names haven't really been rewarded or not.
Yeah. So when you think of obviously in the last 5 years or so, there's been a dramatic inflow of passive versus active, especially in the U.S. And when you think about all that money that's coming into passive vehicles, when they buy an ETF or they buy an index, you're buying every stock in that index, so it does not differentiate amongst any of the stocks. And so what that tends to do is it not only brings up the biggest stocks in the benchmark or the best stocks in the benchmark, it brings up all the bad stocks, the bad companies in the benchmark as well. And so when all the stocks are actually working and all those ones are coming in and those stocks are being bought, it does make the benchmark a little bit harder to beat. We do think that at some point we think the scales are going to tilt, because you've seen a chart actually this morning. The flow is based on a monthly basis, active versus passive, over the last 5 years, and it feels like it's at a peak. And we do think that it's actually causing some distortions in the market, that it's just, there's mispricing opportunities, we think, in our mind, that are happening because of it, but it's definitely a challenge for us. And I think part of it is that there's probably an element of quantitative easing that's come in as interest rates have been low and people are just putting a lot of money to work and a lot more risk-taking. But we do think as that starts to unwind, and I think active management, just like a lot of other things, is cyclical. And so I do have a chart in the back that actually shows the rolling percentage of managers that have outperformed their benchmark over the years, and it shows that we're actually at a bit of a trough right now. Now, I do think that given that the correlations are going to start to come down again and it's going to be a better environment for active management, we should see that start to improve. You see it's actually at a bottom right here. And then prior markets, we've seen in the very back of the deck, I don't know if you guys want to flip to the back real quick, but I can just show you the chart that I'm referencing. I'm going to get off topic a little bit. But on slide 3, actually slide 2 and slide 3 are actually two pretty good slides. And slide 2 talks to the point that I was making at the beginning of the conversation around dividend yield and low volatility. You can see on that right-hand side, on the top chart on slide 2, you can show that those are the stocks that have the highest dividend yield and the lowest volatility profiles, and they've outperformed the S&P 500 by a dramatic amount. And then the outcome of that, I think, is because the market's been so narrow, you see the outcome is the large cap growth category is underperformed on that slide 3, and so it does tend to be cyclical at times. And what's unique about this environment versus the environment back in sort of 98 or even in 2006 is that the market was very narrow. So there tended to be a small component of stocks that were actually working, and in this case it's been dividend yield and low vol. And we think as, hopefully the environment starts to widen out and correlations come down and it's not so narrow, that it should be a better opportunity for active managers moving forward. So it definitely has been a struggle. And I don't want to use these as poor excuses because we have underperformed, and we want to acknowledge that.
What was your January performance? Do you have that?
We were probably, this is gross of fees, we were probably 15 or 20 basis points ahead of the benchmark. It was probably just under 5% or so. So it was a very strong January for the market in general. It's just, it continues to just go up, up, up. So maybe just to talk a little bit about the more recent performance, does it make sense to cover the quarter or the year, or what makes the most amount of sense?
Yeah, I think maybe...
Maybe just focus on the year. Maybe that's probably easier. Then we can talk about positioning and outlook. Mm-hmm. All right, so on slide 10, shows, this is a breakdown of our performance for your portfolio relative to the benchmark over the last, for calendar year 2016. And what I will say is that 7.1% return to the Russell 1000 growth benchmark is a little bit, I don't think it does the market justice for what it was like last year. So if you think about the beginning of 2016, we had a dramatic sell-off in the market. If you guys remember that, there was concerns about China and oil prices were touching $25 lows. And the Russell 1000 growth was down about 13 or 14% in the first 6 weeks of the year. And then it dramatically rebounded about 20% back up to August. And then we had another sell-off and then again a rally through the end of the year. So it's been, you know, quite a volatile year with a lot of different macro-driven events. Correlations were pretty low. Stocks were really kind of moving in the same direction, especially around things like Brexit. And obviously, the U.S. presidential elections had a lot of investors concerned. But again, we did underperform. What this chart shows is the attribution outlook. So this is really where we underperformed and where we actually added value. You can see on the far right-hand side of this chart, information technology was really the weakest area of the portfolio for calendar year 2016. You know, a lot of the stocks that were part of that widely underperformed, you can see in that under that box that says top relative detractors, and the four companies that you see listed there are all technology companies. At the top there, rather than the top, there's that first technology company called NVIDIA, which was up 200% last year. We didn't own it in the portfolio, so that's why it was a big detractor for us. They basically make computer graphics processing chips for basically for video games. I don't know if you play video games, your kids or people are pretty crazy about it. And we didn't own it because it was not attractive to us from a valuation perspective. And then Microsoft was a bit of a challenge because we're a bit underweight. We do own a position in Microsoft in the portfolio, but it did detract because of we didn't have a big active weight. It's about 3.5% in the benchmark, so it's tough to get a big weight in some of these stocks, just given, you know, from a risk control perspective. And then Apple. Apple's been a tough one for us as well. We still own it in the portfolio. We're a little bit overweight. We still like it, but it's been a bit of a volatile stock as well. In terms of things that actually did work well for us in 2016, you can see on the far left-hand side of that attribution chart, we had, in particular, energy and materials companies did quite well for your portfolio. The company at the top there called Linear Technology, which is a tech company that basically makes semiconductors that go into a lot of different types of products. That was bought out by a company called Analog Devices, so it added 40 basis points of relative performance. And then some of the energy companies did quite well, like Baker Hughes, so they do a lot of energy and equipment. They're merging with GE's oil and gas business, and we think there's going to be a lot of synergies that can come out of that. So Baker Hughes has been a good stock for your portfolio. And then not only Nike. Nike's had a lot of challenges in terms of their channel and their business this year. We don't own it in your portfolio. So those are a couple of snapshots in terms of how we did for 2016. If you have any more specific questions about that, I'm happy to address them. If not, maybe we can talk a little bit about maybe positioning or a little bit about outlook. Is that...
Yeah, I think just wrap up a couple minutes with
Outlook. Sure. So Outlook is on page 14. So we added a couple of quick bullet points, you know, from our perspective on how we're kind of viewing the market right now moving forward. And at the top, I make the point about better business sentiment potentially leading to higher CapEx. And so what a lot of public companies have been doing with their cash over the last few years is really buying back stock. You know, the economic environment's been, there's been a lot of uncertainty. Businesses have not been spending or reinvesting in their own business. They've instead taken the low interest rates and basically bought stock back, which for them, it's kind of, instead of maybe increasing their dividend or doing something like that, buying back stock, you can announce a buyback and then you can cancel it. And just really, you don't get the same impact as, you know, if you cut your dividend. So a lot of companies have been putting a lot of money into buying back stock. We think as business sentiment is starting to improve, that, you know, companies should start to invest more in their own businesses. You know, economic growth expectations in the U.S. are still 1.5% to 2%, but if we can get more to 3.5%, which is what, you know, we're starting to hear about the targets out of Washington, that, you know, companies could get more excited about their, you know, their outlooks, and they could start spending more. And so we do have a lot of potential beneficiaries in the portfolio that would benefit from that. So things like U.S. infrastructure spending, so industrials is an area of the portfolio that we've been putting more money to work in recently. And then, you know, other potential CapEx beneficiaries would be actually in technology, as the financial companies actually get potentially relief on the regulatory side. They actually do spend a lot of money on technology in terms of CapEx for their technology spend. And so there could be a boost to some of those companies spending more on the tech side, and we do have a lot of technology exposure. The second point on regulation in the banking sector, I think regulation in general is kind of something that Paul's been a little bit excited about in the last couple of years, or last couple of months. You know, obviously nothing's been actually done in Washington, but just the potential for it has gotten people excited. And so if you think about things like, you know, two examples, one in financials. So there's been the regulatory burdens on a lot of financial companies over the last years has been pretty tremendous. You know, think about the Dodd-Frank bill has really put a lot of onerous regulations on top of these companies. You know, for example, JP Morgan has 43,000 people that just focus on compliance alone. And so we think that, and they spent $9 million on it last year, and so we think if some of that regulation comes down, in addition to better economic growth, higher interest rates, and less regulatory hurdles, we think that there could be some opportunities in financials. It's not a huge component of what we do.
Do you anticipate if there was a deregulation of the financial industry that there will be mass layoffs? And what impact do you think that would have if those 43,000 employees need to be 20,000 employees?
Yeah. Well, so that's a good question. Obviously, regulatory burdens and financials are not going away. It's just some of the reporting requirements have been so onerous on these companies, they have to spend so much. You know, I think that you might give up jobs in some area, but you might gain them in other areas, right? So if let's say you cut down your compliance staff by 10,000, but the economic environment in the U.S. is getting better for those companies, then they'll hire more people in other areas of the business. So it's not necessarily a loss
right.
in one area.
Lower end, lower paying jobs.
Not necessarily. I mean, you might be hiring people that can, they're loaning money to individuals, you have more loan officers, more, you know, different other parts. It's not just...
Those are still lower-paying jobs that are compliance.
Not necessarily. I mean, there's compliance jobs that actually pay pretty low, and they're pretty challenging with the jobs, so it's not, I wouldn't call it a perfect one for one.
I just worry that, you know, I'm all for deregulation because there's way too much of it. Just the thought of, you know...
It's not going away.
Right.
It's not going away.
They'll never go away, but, you know, just having unemployment, you know, start to rise again because, you know, those... Retooling those people, do they have to still... Your compliance officer doesn't make you a loan officer. I mean, you have to retool, you know, so there's just a... Could be just a slide. I just don't know if you factor that into...
No, I mean, I think, again, it's like the pickup you're gaining in one side of the business, you might be giving up some on the other, so it's probably not a perfect bet for one, but I think in general, it could be better for the companies and better for the economy if these companies are also doing better, right? So, like, part of it is that, you know, they're not able to loan capital as much as they used to, so there's small businesses out there that don't have access to capital because of the strict regulations, and if those do come down, there could be small businesses that do get access to loans and capital to grow their business, so there are... You know, pick up some one area that you might lose in the other. It's, you know, economics is never a perfect one for one.
We might get some of those call centers back also from the Philippines and India.
Yeah, some
low-paying jobs. Okay. But jobs are jobs, right? I mean, jobs are, even if they're low-paying jobs, it's still economic opportunity. The other area that I make a point on number three is that we have seen some interesting opportunities in underappreciated sector growth. So some of the industrial companies, as I mentioned, we have been lowering our underweight to that because we have seen some pretty interesting opportunities. Caterpillar is one company that we bought more recently, so they've really struggled over the last 3 or 4 years. So there's been, I think that prior to the last 4 years, they've never had sort of more than two consecutive revenue decline years in a row. They've had four. And so they've really struggled in terms of, they sell most of their businesses is construction equipment and global mining. Equipment, and so those are industries that have really struggled in the last few years, and we do think that the tides are turning on some of those industries, especially if you get infrastructure spend or lower taxes, and so we do think that, you know, Caterpillar does offer a good opportunity for us to take advantage of some of that. We've also invested in a few other industrial companies like Parker Hannifin, Dover, some of these more production-oriented manufacturing type companies that should benefit from better economic growth in the U.S. The last couple of points I'll just make is that maybe I'll just point on number five because I do feel like, you know, our turnover in this portfolio is about 50%, so we do, our holding period is about 2 to 3 years. We do think that holding periods have generally come down over the last few years, so people are just, turnover is a lot higher, investors are turning things around a lot more quick, tends to be more headline driven, more news driven, and we do think that By having this longer-term, multi-year investment horizon, we do think that in owning these capital compounding businesses over time, it should benefit our shareholders. Obviously, as I mentioned early on, that we have not met our investment objective over the last few years, but we do have a lot of optimism for the portfolio moving forward.
Did I see that the risk is equal to the benchmark?
Well, how do you define risk? Beta? Yeah, we tend to be pretty in line with the benchmark. You know, Paul's not going to ever, doesn't really manage a portfolio that's going to have a 1.1 beta. He's not a very beta-driven investor. And if it ever does get too high, it's something that I flag for him. And he is very conscious of making sure that the beta is sort of in line with the market. It's really not, he's not a big, you know, sort of go-go volatility or high beta type of investor. So being in line with the market is kind of what he is kind of.
Active passive is a big thing now.
Yeah.
And, you know, at some point, active has to pay.
I agree. I do. I mean, it's certainly, we've had the headwinds over the last few years. And again, I do think that it's interesting when you look at, so when stocks are all moving in the same direction, I think the passive component is certainly driving some of that. And so we haven't, the last 5 years, we haven't seen correlations as high as they've been since the 1920s and 30s. And so in between those two time periods, correlations were low, and managers, active managers, did a really good job beating their benchmarks.
But if you have less risk,
yeah,
I can understand the difference, but you'll have the same risk.
Yeah, but but just because you have the same beta doesn't mean that you can't outperform a benchmark. It's just more that, you know, it's more a stock selection component. It's picking the individual names within. Obviously, beta can be, you know, there's, if you're like a 0.8 beta, right, like that's a very different thing than a 1 point beta or a 1.2 beta, right? So it's, you know, Paul has always been very, like he's always managed to sort of a 1.0 beta his entire career. It's really not the type of bet that he looks to make. You know, it's not making, so if you have a 1.2 beta, you're really making a bet on the market, and that's just really not what he does. It's really, it's all fundamental stock selection. So just because you do have a beta of 1 does not mean that you can't outperform your benchmark. And again, we recognize that we haven't done that, but, you know, we are optimistic for the future.
Any other areas of time? Any other questions for us?
Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for your time and your business. And if there are any follow-up questions or concerns, Rose has my contact details. I'll leave a couple of cards. I know I'm a relationship manager to your plan, so I'll leave a few cards and happy to take questions or emails, calls, whatever.
Yeah.
Thank you
very much.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Again, hopefully we'll stay an extra day.
Thanks, Rose.
Thank you. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Take care. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Enjoy the weather.
Thanks. Okay. From Foster and Foster Experience.
The timing on the experience that I'm going to recommend is actually for the May meeting for a couple of reasons. One is we're so close to completing the 16 valuation that there would be no reason to do assumptions that are already, you know, almost 2 years old at this point based on experience. And so I'd like to get another year of experience in, which is through fiscal 16. And get the valuation out of the way. We're about probably 3 weeks out. That's actually typical for when we get the general valuation done here at Ocala. I'm here to present the police valuation today, but I'm telling Alicia, police is like this, and general's like, there's so many moving parts of general. It's such a mature plan that has different benefit structures over the decades. It just, the sheer manpower just takes longer to do. So
I have a question related to that. Is there anything that we can do to expedite that or push back when we get that you know, our capper can't drop until we get...
Correct.
That's it. And we have a March 31 deadline, and you're saying weeks, so you are putting me in a very bad position.
I understand.
So basically, we're sitting around waiting for one report to put our financials out, and we'd like to put them out as early as possible.
Yeah, it's one report, but it's...
I understand that, and my understanding is we're getting the data to you in the November...
Well, the census data, yes, which is its own, and that by itself wouldn't hold things up, but the financial side, you've got 14 active managers. There's so much transaction, there's so much going on, that the back and forth takes several months to get everything hashed out. I want to give you a better answer every year, and I can't unless we can get all of, you know, like, the best dump of financial data in October, early November, and then we can start working on it. But it's just the nature of the timing and the sheer complexity that we're always pushed right until early March to get it out.
We're getting pressure that they don't want the capper going out that late. Just, you know. So is there, can we lean on managers? I mean, like, what can we do if the managers are not being responsive? You know,
it's the same thing every year. I mean, you could pull out information we've given out for the last 10 years in a row and resubmit that and say we really need, you know, 90% of the financial information before Thanksgiving to even have a chance of getting it out in February. I don't want to, and I know it's not the answer you want to hear, but I don't want to sugarcoat it at the same time and say, oh yeah, we'll do better next year. And it's really not a matter of doing better. It's a matter of getting a substantial part of the information early enough.
That's what I'm asking. Is there something we can do to help get the managers to comply? Are they...
You can give them drop-dead dates to say, look, September 30th, that might even take days to get the full answer. That's how much sheer information there is with this plan. I say if you send out the notice, like, look, when the financial information needed to complete the valuation and the GASBs and the CAFR is needed by the actuary, complete by Thanksgiving every year, then we have, then, yeah, it's just what happens is we get the information and we start digging into it with the team, and then we have follow-up questions, because the initial set of information, the reason I had to say no later than Thanksgiving is because it's never perfect the first time. There's always back and forth, always. And then we have to review the answers and then get back. And often the answers we have to review again. So we really need everything, the initial dump, by Thanksgiving. And even then, it's going to come right down into February. Still probably late February. Now, if the financial information can be available as the initial dump in early November, then maybe it can be early to mid-February. It really takes about 3 months from when we get the first data to finished product. So I'm trying to be realistic.
Well, and I'm going to say the interesting thing. We're going to do what we do, and I can see if there's anything that, you know, if we can assist in any way, that's like my objective. We can, you know, maybe give the managers deadlines or...
That would be the deadline. That would be the deadline. If you pick, you would do this, pick the CAFR date that you would like, at least the GASB schedules. Right. Now, the valuation can maybe follow a week or two later.
Right.
But the GASB stuff is what you need.
Yeah.
Pick that date and back it up 3 months. That's the drop-dead date.
There should be no reason any money manager can't get you stuff by November 1st.
And I guess my question is, when you say, is there anything that we can do, do you mean the city or do you mean the court?
Well, I was saying from the city standpoint, you know, I'm holding the right letters or do whatever we need to do, you know, with, you know, the board's blessing, of course, not like irritating all the managers.
Does the board get involved in that kind of stuff typically?
I do. I mean, I usually
So perhaps.
I'm waiting on a couple of real estate investment statements, some invoices, that kind of thing. In late October, November. That's usually, I'm waiting on a few pegs to fill in and then we can ship off the information.
Yeah, I guess, you know, kind of initial correspondence from the board that says we gotta have this stuff by this 3 months. And then the stragglers, then you guys get involved, you know, maybe halfway through and say, guys, you know, we gotta have this by.
Right, so, I mean, the pensions need to put their financials out, and that's what we're producing, is the pension system's financial statement.
Yeah.
You know, it's, there are statutory deadlines by which we need to meet them, so we want to just avoid that rush to the end, because then my finance department is working, you know, literally around the clock. They're here all night long, all through the weekend, after we get those reports, trying to, like, get it to press.
Trust me, I know every year it's like, Ocala bills start going off in January, and we're still in the thick of the back and forth.
And this is something we perhaps could do on a due diligence basis when we speak with these managers in the future, and just say, you know, we have our requirements in terms of filings, and, you know, our relationship with you. They have something to do with not only your performance, but also the asset indigestion that you perhaps alleviate us from having with regard to providing us the data for actuaries. So I think there are probably a number of things that we can do to make that
better. Yeah, I mean, even backing up this in a couple of weeks makes a huge difference.
All around,
because we have all kinds of stuff we have to do. I mean, it takes us months to put our statements together.
This is the only thing you're doing,
right? Yeah, I wish I could dedicate myself full time to just doing this, but alas, they have these little things they need to do. All right, well, maybe we can send some letters to the managers, and hopefully, maybe proactively now for next year, let them know that, hey, you know, stuff costs a buster by this date, and if you have any concerns, you know, once you get done with evaluation this year, if you have any managers in particular that you have a lot more back and forth with, or, you know, we can maybe outline some of those concerns and say, hey, you know, we typically are missing this or that, or, you know, can you make sure that your initial jump has these things? Worth a shot.
Yeah, it is.
So I can at least tell my board I've been proactive in trying to, you know, get what I needed to get.
Right. Understood. So, with that said, I am going to be here giving the experience day for police in May, and I'll let the board decide how they want to go with this. I definitely am going to be here at the same May meeting to give you your 16 valuation. It's quite a bit to actually do a valuation and an experience study in the same meeting. So, but I can do it, or you can let me know if you'd rather have me come back at the August meeting with the experience study and just deal with that then. So your choice, and you have more choices than this, but the two logical ones are come back in May, here's your valuation and an experience study, so the actuary is here for a long time. Or say, no, just come with the valuation in May, come with the experience study in August. So how would you like to go about that? Or another alternative that I haven't thought about.
So when you say it's pretty lengthy to do both,
it could take 3 hours. But just, you know, this board is very, very thoughtful in their task as trustees, and so there's lots of good questions. There's good back and forth. So I imagine the experience study alone would take several hours. Special meeting, yep. My schedule starts opening up a little more beginning later in April through the summer a bit, so I've got some more availability. So whatever would work for this board for a special meeting, I could do that too. And the special meeting could handle both reports so that no one else has to be here but the actuary. or I could come for, well, the experience study and evaluation, like if you just had a meeting just for that, just the actuary, that might not be so bad as, you know, when you got the consultant, managers, attorney, that's a long, long day.
That might be the way to go then, do that. Have them both on the same day, just do it at a special meeting where we have nothing else to consider. So how do we come about with the date?
I would say anything probably past late April.
Staying with a Monday, is a Monday a problem?
You throw out some dates and I can check my calendar, I checked my calendar even today, logged on. But you can check, you can throw out other dates after this meeting and I'll respond real quickly and let you know.
Late April.
Yeah, and then they'll probably know earlier than late April. Because if that was desired, then I'd want to make sure the experience study got done early enough.
So, need a motion if we want to do a special meeting? No? Okay. What I'll do is I'll coordinate with Doug and Lee and get some dates, send them out to everyone, so when you're available.
Perfect.
Sounds good.
I guess the only other update I have is Rose and I have coordinated, so we'll get you the dashboard information. You're all, of course, pretty much up to speed on, they made the request, right? It was an update on the funded status, like every 6 months or so. So we'll start including that with the valuation report going forward.
Just remember, you voted, sorry, you have new policy guidelines that you voted on, and in that, you know, we had gone through a long time of education and looking at different things about risk and how important risk was and to look at risk over time. And so you have that now in your guidelines. So every 6 months, I will put in my report what your funded status is. So I talked to Doug about that to get the number from him so that I can keep that updated so you can sort of see. Because we do have something in our guidelines, if you get to 80% funded, and I know that's sort of where you are now, but if we ever get to 80% funded, we will dial down the risk even more, and just to keep track of that.
That's a good point ever.
That's all right. When do we get to 80% funded?
It will happen, it's designed to happen.
Yes, and, it will.
And the reason I say that,
we say all retired when it happens, but it will happen. So those people.
Here's a question I have for you, Rose. As part of the experience study, and this is a question not just for Rose but the board. Do you have a desire to see a scenario of lowering the investment assumption below the 7%? Remember that was handed to you by ordinance, probably almost 5 years ago, and that's not bad. I mean, 7% is very good. It's. I mean, the Florida retirement system is now on a 13-year glide path to get down to 7.65.
It was legislated, right?
Yeah.
The 7 here? Yeah.
What's
here?
7.65. No, for us.
7.65.
Well, it's like, yeah, their board, their plan administrator is really the legislator, so they determine the assumptions.
Well,
it's
7.6 now.
It's 7.6, yeah.
Right, because they did just do a 0.85 lower.
Yeah, so they're
stepping it down.
So, should we look at something lower than 7, at least as a scenario? I'm not saying I would recommend it necessarily, but, or should we do all the different options just at the current 7?
And what, there's some kind of guidance about like 6.75 being,
well, that depends, but I'm not going to tread too much into Rose's territory here.
I don't know.
How long have we been at 7 then?
About 4 or 5 years, I think. But you did it all, boom, all at once. Part of the reason the funded ratio went is with that immediate reduction.
I mean, I still see the average in the country. Doug can speak to this too. At 7.5, that's where I see most people at. That doesn't mean that's the magic number either.
Because that's where the big boys are and everybody follows them.
So 7.5 is where a lot of people are. You are close, plan, so you're different. So 7 makes sense.
Yeah, and a lot of, you know, entities are reluctant to lower because it got checked. You got to write, picks up, and it should factor into the decision, but...
I mean, there will come a point when you will need to lower it below 7. I just don't know if I necessarily want to throw it out there now, because as soon as the actuary gives it as a scenario, and you don't do it, somebody might question why you didn't do it. As the actuary, I'm still comfortable with the 7.
And I'm comfortable with the 7, so...
So maybe on this run of the experience study, we'll just leave it at 7 and look at everything else. And
just from the state's perspective, we haven't had any discussion about changing it or lowering it, or there's no movement around any change coming from my elected body.
Okay, so I think we have the answer for now. And if, by the way, that doesn't tie your hands, you know, if next year, after we adopt new assumptions, say, you know, we want to start looking at... You can always do that.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Ms. Rose. Welcome back again, by the way.
Nice to see everyone. I talked to Arnie between, and he said Rob did a good job, so I'm feeling felt that way. I work with Rob a lot in the Atlanta office, so he said it was a good meeting. So I'm going to just go through performance like I always do, and we can talk a little bit about it. Under tab 1, we always like to talk about the markets. You need a backdrop of what the markets have done to really understand how your performance has done. So there is a webinar. It's happening, I think, this week. So if you didn't get that, I'll send it again to Alicia so she can send it to whoever. You don't have to be a board member. Anybody can, come on that webinar. And they go through the whole market conditions, whereas I just go through a few pages. So during the fourth quarter, the MSCI World, which includes all equities, so that would be U.S. and non-U.S. equities, was up 1.86%. For the one-year period, it was up 7.5%. So you can see some improvement there in the three-year, the five-year, and the 10-year number coming up for the MSCI World, given the returns for this year. The Russell 3000, which is small cap, mid cap, and large cap stocks, was up 4% for the quarter, and up almost 13% for the year, bringing the 10-year number up to 7%. The MSCI EAFE, which is Developed International Stocks, which has been really, really hammered on the last 3 years, as you can see it is negative, was up 1% for the year. And then the three-year, five-year, 10-year, 10-year is basically still flat for the EAFE. The MSCI Emerging Markets Index, that's the EM index, it did have a negative quarter. A lot of that was just currency effects. So in local currency, they were up. But then when you translated it back to U.S. dollars, it became negative. But you could see the strong return of 11%. You did get into emerging markets. That's a newer asset class you added in the last 2 or 3 years. When you added it, it was maybe like the worst time to add it, but it's actually been really positive for you this year. I think your manager was up 13% versus the 11 of this index. Bonds, we had been talking about, the rally in bonds and, 30-year rally in bonds, and when was it going to end, and when was it going to end, and we've been talking about that for maybe 5 years now, and so you finally see a negative quarter for bonds, and I think it's the largest negative quarter in the last 35 years or something, so, and you'll see that by, we'll look at the yield curve in a minute. And then non-U.S. WGBI, that's just non-U.S. bonds, negative, strong negative for the quarter. You can see the 1 year a little positive, you can see 3, 5, and 10-year returns there. Commodities had a good year, strong performance there, but you can see negative across the board. You don't have any commodities in your portfolio per se. You don't have a commodities manager. Real estate did well, and your manager's done better than that. Private equity, this is a little bit of a lag number, so that number is through the second and third quarter. And then hedge funds had another really difficult year, almost returning a percent, and you can look at the 10-year number for hedge funds. Very, very muted. We'll move into, you know, all these charts in here remain the same. We just update them from quarter to quarter. We'll move on to page 6, which talks about the S&P 500. The S&P 500 was up 3.82% for the quarter, so strong coming off the election. Stocks really rallied, and you can see up almost 12% for the year, so really strong numbers there. Value and growth mattered, and so did size. So you can look there, growth underperformed value. If you look at the Russell 1000, value was 17% versus the growth of 7%. So, you know, value was definitely in favor over the year period. And you can see small cap stocks outperform large cap stocks significantly. We'll move on to the bond market on page 10. So we talked about all of the negatives in the bond market, and you can see the exception was high yield. High yield had a very strong year, up 17%. And your fixed income manager just had some bonds in that portfolio, and that's why they did so well over the one-year period, outperforming the benchmark. And on page 11, you can see why bonds did poorly. You had a huge shift in the yield curve. The Fed did increase rates during the quarter, and you can see this large shift on the yield curve there. Actually, the 10-year note rose from 1.6% at the end of September to 2.44% at the end of December, which was an 84 basis point change. So that's one of the largest changes we've seen in a long time. So that's basically it. I always like to talk about the noteworthy developments on page 18 and 19. So all the pages in this are the same, and we just update from quarter to quarter, and then these pages are a little bit different. So we put in the Fed debt increase, because as interest rates do go up, our debt's going to cost more, and so you can sort of see the federal debt increase there.
Isn't there a debt ceiling coming up?
Yes, I think so. And then currency risk out there in a market. A lot of those foreign investments have done very well. Internationally, investments, if you were in local currency, did really well. Well, the strong dollar, as we translate that through, has caused the negative returns that we see, or the really muted returns of the European market. Talk about infrastructure. The president's talking about infrastructure, so this was just really interesting to see federal spending on infrastructure versus state and local spending. And so you can see how long, really, the federal government's percent of spending versus state and local work on infrastructure. And then ESG funds, I think I've mentioned this to you before. We can always do sort of an education presentation on ESG. ESG investing means environmental, social, and governance investing. And it's becoming more and more popular, and I think it will just continue to grow, over the years, where pension funds tend to really want to be owners, but also influence in what's happening in the markets and in the stocks. So we'll move on to your specific performance. So we always look at page 24. And just remind everybody, this is your targets that set your policy index. So whenever we do an asset allocation study, which we do every 3 or 4 years, to see if you're still on target, if you need to move your assets around any, this is your targets that are in your policy index on the left. And then on the right is where your actual positions in those asset classes are as of the time. No major differences. If you look at equity, your target is 42. You're at 42.9, so you're slightly over, but not significantly. Your fixed income target's 32. You're a little bit under at 30.7. Your real estate target's 12.5. You're at 12.3, so pretty close there. Your target to alternatives is at 13.5, and you're at 11.9. So it's a little bit under there. To have a total asset value of $126,829,330 as of December. The next page is your investment roster. We put this in only on an annual basis. This just gives you the fees of your managers, so you can see what each manager is charging you. And then you can see what your total cost of the plan is, which is about 67 basis points, which is absolutely in the range of, you know, of plans this size. Given some of your alternatives, it's maybe a little bit higher, but not outside the median, not outside the top of the range, given that you have all active management. And as we go through the returns, we can talk about active versus passive and have that conversation. So if you look on the next page, this is your performance for your total fund. So for the quarter, you did outperform your policy index 0.08, and for the year-to-date period, you did outperform 6.97%. You can see your three-year was under, your five-year was basically in line, and your seven-year was in line. You outperformed on the 10-year and since inception. So we're going to go through each manager and sort of see if we had some underperformance there, but most plans I've come to present to, the domestic equity portfolio is underperforming. And it's because, sort of like you said, 85-90% of active managers have underperformed the benchmark for 2016. So it has been the actual worst year in recorded history for active managers. So some would say that's the reason why you should now go into active management, right? Reversion to the mean, yeah. Right.
Are we entering another period of irrational exuberance?
Right, and then some people would say, well, it's a new normal and active managers aren't going to be able to outperform at all ever again. So those are sort of the two cases. But we'll look at your specific managers and then maybe have a conversation around that. We'll move to page 30 and we'll go through each manager, and then there's a couple that, including Wellington, that we want to talk about. So Wedge did underperform for the quarter and the year, but you can see their 3-year, their 5-year, their 7-year, their 10-year, and their since inception has outperformed. They're a strong manager. I see their performance coming back. Oh no, I did take some notes if I had updated. I didn't get updated performance for them, but a lot of managers in January have started to outperform, like Wake Wellington did. So Wellington, we had in here today, underperformed for the quarter, underperformed a lot for the year, the 3-year, the 5-year, and then the since inception period. So somebody we're definitely watching, the reason why we had them in today. Siegel Bryant Hamill, underperforming for the quarter and the year. Underperforming the 3-year, the 5-year, and the since inception. So those are really the two managers that we will want to talk about. Templeton has a little bit of emerging markets in their portfolio, but not as much as the ACWI. So we put both benchmarks here because it's hard when emerging markets are doing really, really well. We really can't compare Templeton to that benchmark, but when emerging markets are doing really negative, it's going to pull down Templeton versus the EFI. So that's why we show both. But you can see they outperform the EFI for the quarter, the year, the 3 years they lagged, the 5 years they outperform the ACWI. So, you know, that's tough there, but they underperform the EFI on the 7-year. Since inception, they've outperformed. 10-year, they outperform both indexes and since inception. Acadian, we were worried about them. You had hired them in 11. Emerging markets had done so poorly. You're finally back in the black again, so we're happy to see that. And great performance for the year. Really helped the performance of your total fund with them outperforming 13 versus 11. Pyramus did very well, though negative for the quarter. Outperformed the benchmark, but you can see over all periods measured, they have done very well. 6.5% return versus a 2% benchmark. Absolutely what you want to see from them. Double Line outperformed for the quarter, but under for the year, outperforming since inception. They're a little bit newer for you. UBS is your core real estate manager. Core has had a tough time with valuations. They did return a 7% return for the year, but they're underperforming on the 3, 5, 7, and 10 year. And I think that what we've really talked about there is that we want to keep adding more to value add real estate, which is done better, and take money from them slowly over time to increase the other managers that have done better in real estate. I will tell you that they're one of three top core real estate managers in the country. So switching them out for another manager, I don't know, would give you that much better performance. I think it's just that we need to slowly take down some of that core real estate exposure and add it to value-added real estate. Wellington, you hired them. You had fired Pimco, who was doing this kind of strategy for you, a global tactical asset allocation strategy. They came in. Outperformed for the quarter, though negative, but if you look at since inception, they did well, and they've been very additive to your portfolio. Atil's another manager we're watching. So we've got Wellington we're watching, Single Bryan Hamill, and Atil's. Atil's just reduced their fee again. I had them into another Florida public pension plan. We're very, very concerned about the performance of hedge fund managers. This one does outperform. You look at the five-year return, they did outperform, and the seven-year, they're under a little bit. Since inception, they're under. We want hedge funds to not be at 2%. We want them to be at the 8-9%, which is what you need. That's what we hired them to do. It's been a tough market to do that when you've basically had, a muted. You have a run in the equity markets, and then you've got bonds, and they're supposed to do in between. So if you look at them, they've mostly done in between bonds and stocks, but not as well as we wanted them to do. I think that that's something that we need to watch over the next, say, one or two quarters. If we really don't see hedge funds turning around, I think we're going to want to look at maybe doing something different there, because it's just a lot to pay for somebody who's not performing what you want to do, and I think Arnie's talked about that too in the past. So we'll continue to talk about them. Just page 32 goes through your real estate managers. These are your closed-end real estate managers, so they're measured on a little bit of a different basis. They're measured on an IRR basis. And you can really see, you look at the since inception IRRs, which you want to look at, and they've done very well. Just what you wanted. These two newer managers, Westport and Long Wharf, are still in what we call the J curve a little bit, which just means they're buying buildings, they're buying properties, they haven't fixed them up yet, so the appraisals aren't going to come in until they've had a chance to reposition them and fix them up some. So you're not going to see that come out for a little bit. Westport, you've seen they're out of the J curve a little bit here. You could see a 9% return for the year.
Do we have an IRR target for these guys?
In your asset allocation, we target, we say that we think real estate will return 7% over time. These managers, though, are set to return, and they come in, each of them have their sort of different ones when I present them, but it's between 10 and 12% is what we're looking for them to do. So some of the ones that are closer to core, core value add, they're buying B properties or C properties and fixing them up, are not going to do as well as a manager who's like doing development or buying a D property and repositioning it to an A property. So I would expect like a Town Square to probably do better than like a Longboard. So let's go back to, just look at Wellington and Wedge and Siegel, Bryan, Hamill and look at your equity positioning there and sort of talk about, active versus passive management. We really believe that in the small cap space, international space, and in alternative spaces, active management can add value. There's places, it's not as an efficient market. You can get an edge. In the large cap space, it's hard. It's hard to get that alpha. And then you're paying a manager, you might pay a passive manager 5 basis points, 6 basis points, whatever, and you're paying an active manager 60 basis points, right? So, and then if you don't see the alpha, then you're overpaying to not even get what the benchmark did, right? So So, you know, so that's the argument. You know, a lot of people would say, well, passive has run for so long now, getting into passive, this might just be the chance when your active managers can finally start to outperform. So I'll just open that up if people want to sort of talk about their comments around that.
I think you need both. You need active and passive. You're going to see a big cost savings with some passive, like for your large cap. What would you do by ETFs?
No, we have institutional. We have institutional. Even Vanguard, but you could get an institutional class commingled fund like you do with that would give you would charge 5 or 6 basis points, maybe less, and just manage to the S&P 500. If that's what you want, you could do a Russell 1000. You've done large value and large growth for a long time. So I think it's just something I could bring maybe an educational presentation and talk about passive versus active maybe to the next meeting and sort of talk about that. But I'm not against, you taking your managers, or maybe just Wellington if you felt like that to passive. You can get a Russell 1000 growth index passive. Wedge has added value, on a net of fee basis. They have outperformed. Not as recent, but if you look at the, 5-year, 7-year, 10-year, since inception numbers, they have outperformed. Their fee is, their fee is 50 basis points. So even if you take 50 basis points off that, they still outperform the benchmark. So you're better off with Wedge, having Wedge. In your portfolio than you would have been having a passive manager.
With regard to Wellington, the model that that manager comes from, what is the likelihood that we will return to the type of environment where that would do what he's done prior to these last years?
A lot of managers are saying January, you really saw that, a return to fundamentals, a return to managers. Like, I don't want to say, you've heard the term junk rally for a while, but, a lot of managers are saying, we can't just buy everything. We're looking for managers who are in a good, solid position, have a good business model, who are, are out there to, when we think are positioned well to make money, we can't buy everything. And the everything was doing well, and especially the really lower stuff was doing well. Low quality is what they would call it, was doing well. But in January, they saw that reverse, where the market was rewarding companies that had that. Wellington did outperform slightly in January, and the other managers I've seen even outperform more. So I think that 2017, we may see a rotation to that. We saw the early signs of that. I think it might be a little too early to see about 2017, but I'm not recommending you fire anybody here today,
right.
But I think it's something we need to really talk about some more, and that if we want to move to more of an index strategy on your large cap, I'm not against that. Wedge, I think that they've done well, and I think they're going to continue. So maybe not there, but if Wellington continues that, paying them 60 basis points to underperform over a 5-year period by 1.5%, almost 2% when you add the fees in, that's not what you're doing. And your guidelines are very clear that you want them to outperform over a 3- and 5-year period. They've had 5 years to do that. 2016 was sort of a strange year, so giving them a little bit of time I can see, but not a long, a long period of time to see that return. I would like to bring SBVH to the next meeting. They've underperformed. I think we need to hear from them. We haven't heard from them in a while. I'm going to have my research group have a meeting with them too. They underperformed, and even in January, I got their January returns, they did underperform. little positive in January, so I'd like to bring them into the next meeting, hear from them. They underweighted financials and overweighted healthcare, and that really did affect them in 2016. So you don't really need a vote on me to bring them in, but I just wanted to let you know that. Our research group, I've been trying to, as you know, we bought Marco Advisors. So we bought another firm in January 1st. It was official. So we even added to our research group more. So now we have close to 40 people in our research group. So they'll be doing more managers, but they've met with Westport, Wellington, Acadian, Long Wharf, Colony, Double Line, and Wedge over the last year of your managers, where they've done onsites of calls in our research group. So they continue to do that sort of behind the scenes. And you're welcome to anytime, you know, ask me about it or go through any specifics on any managers. I will let you know that your ranking versus other state plans, in the state of Florida, I know everybody looks at themselves versus versus other people. You have a 7% return assumption. The way I positioned your assets, your closed plan, they're more conservative than a lot of your peers. So if equity markets are up a lot, you are not going to perform as well as another plan who's maybe target 7.5% or 8% return, because their assets are positioned differently. If you look at your five-year return, that's probably very competitive versus other plans in the state. But the further we go from your plan being closed and me repositioning your assets to reduce the risk, just know that you may, you may have your friends out there in Tallahassee performing 7.5% for the year, maybe 8% for the year. You only require 6.97%. So you're just gonna, when equity markets do really well, you're not gonna do as well as them because you have less risk, and I positioned your portfolio that way on purpose. Okay, so know that.
Some of those attorneys would be so testy. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Attorney's report. Okay. New updates. As you know, the legislature actually is in session now. They don't have any committee meetings. The general session starts March 7th and then runs through the 60-day period until adjourn in May. Hopefully we'll come out basically unscathed this year. They've done enough to us the last several, more than enough. Right now, there's two bills that have been pre-filed, which one of them is just essentially Scrivener's changes. That's Senate Bill 306, and that deals with the situation where a trustee abstains from voting, and that really hadn't changed. You've got to vote yay or nay as a pension trustee, with one exception, and that's if the vote is on an issue that could inure to your own personal benefit, gain, or loss. And that looks like to me it's just basically Scrivener changes. Another bill, and Doug and I talked a bit about this before the meeting, is Senate Bill 632. And this deals with your assumption on return. And Doug doesn't think much of it, and we'll just wait and see if it passes or not. Basically, what it does is essentially provides that you need to determine a long-range, they call it, return. And that needs to be 50% what you utilize, 50% over a 30-year period. And that provides, if you don't make that, you reduce it until you get it down a quarter of a percent a year. So it's, and that's for periods after January 1st, 2021. But I wouldn't be surprised to see it not pass, and we don't need to really go into it in kind of detail as it does. And if you're doing it, I just wanted to bring your attention to it.
Yeah, Tallahassee is getting into the assumptions business.
Yeah.
Because these funded ratios have gotten up high enough where they need to find another hunt. makes no sense. It's a problem that doesn't exist. It's a solution to a problem that doesn't exist. You know, it's been very few times that we've taken the building block asset allocation from the GASB schedules and built it and added in inflation that the investment assumption used for funding has failed. It's 99% of the time it passed, so hopefully this just dies and they get out of the assumption.
We have lobbyists, so we can actively propose meeting in Tallahassee in a couple of weeks, so I can set up some meetings with our delegation.
That's been going on with some of our other plans too, so that would be good. Where'd you guys get this harebrained idea?
That'd be great. As I mentioned, that's Senate Bill 632. And the sponsor is Brandon.
And I'll close the meetings and then I'll send the board chairs, update.
And you all have your packages, new summary plan descriptions, which now that it looks like the ordinance updating is finished at least for a little while. And I know if you had a chance to go over, but if not, you can go over between now and one of our next meetings.
Yeah, we just handed them out.
Yeah, so you haven't had a chance yet.
Written and discussed as simple as the term that anyone can understand.
That's the goal. And the only other item is my annual reminder that I seem to mention for one reason or another for our board meetings a year, and that's your 4-1 financial disclosures. Forms are out now. You can file those in time and file meetings before July 1st.
Or September the 1st.
Well, that's why I mentioned after July 1st, because that's when the fines start to run. That's right. There's a couple other bills, but they don't pertain to general employees, and I'll mention it just so you're aware of the year about it. There are two bills that apply just to firefighters, which would have certain cancers as a presumptive line of duty illness to the benefits of 112. Essentially what was filed for consideration last year, but it didn't get out of committee before session this year. So they're back again. And, another bill directed to firefighters, which I think is the correct anomaly, existed for a long, long time, and that's with respect to confidentiality of certain information for police officers and firefighters. Police officers has long been applicable to active police officers and formers. Who says that? Well, firefighters doesn't say formers. So, and yet we need a good deal. So we'll watch that. But again, that doesn't apply to you.
That we're actively monitoring the other bill for the production. From a cost perspective, that should really drive up, plan costs. If it's all presumed more correlated without a question. There's some talk in there about a physical, but it wouldn't apply to anybody who's employed at that time. And,
it'd be hard to differentiate, wouldn't it?
Yeah, certain limitations of seeing gets physical, and of course we want our firefighters to be protected. We're kind of proactive, we provide the light scan, we're proactive as far as our firefighters are concerned as it relates to their health. Our light scan has actually been beneficial to several firefighters, and they've detected something very early. I think 4 or 5 hours of detecting very early onset, so we're, again, we don't think it's a statewide solution for a local problem. Tallahassee needs to stop. Maybe they're going to ask the legislator up there poking down here, I don't know if all cities are proactive, but, we are. There are a ton of solutions to ensure that our firefighters are healthy and receive the care that they need without legislating that into existence. Undue burden on the taxpayers. So, for example, would be a very cost-effective alternative for students to institute to help.
That's it?
Okay.
Everybody got the minutes from the last meeting and had a chance to read through them? There were two sets of minutes, one for the disability special meeting and then the regular meeting. Thank you. And then the only other thing on the agenda is the handout we have here on expenses.
What we handed out here is just informational for the other, the fire and the police board, they're required to make a motion on the expenses. But for this board, it's just informational. It shows the revenues that we receive through the office, the expenses, and then the retirement payments that went out. On here, there's managers listed. These managers are those that send us an invoice. For instance, Templeton or UBS, they kind of take it off the top before they send us our statements. They don't actually invoice us every month. So these are just the ones that we pay through our accounts payables. This year we had more revenue than expenses, so that was a good thing.
It's always a good thing.
It's just informational so that you can see a little bit of a picture of what we take in and send back out.
And I didn't mention this when I presented, but I think you're at a new high water mark for the amount of, you know, assets in your pension fund at $126 million.
Good job.
I know Doug asked me when we first came in, you know, we have 5 or 6 managers.
I was way off.
Just like we're just gonna score you between the 3 plans. So
okay. If nothing else, call it a journey.
I just want to let you guys know that the IBEW, the General Employees Union, they do, in their contract, they have what's called a reopener. So they have the ability to reopen their contract in January to discuss a pension. To this point, they have not tapped that reopener. They've indicated to us that they intend to. I don't know what that means. I've asked them, what does that look like? You know, can you give me that to cash out? You know, their original objective back when they instituted the union was to return to the old plan. Pretty much told them that's a non-starter. It's not happening. We're not reopening the North Box. We're not just going to reinstitute the plan as this before. So until which point they come to us with some kind of a proposal. They keep saying they have some alternative pension plan. You know, it's, when it comes through, you know, I will, you know, have to leave just to let you know, because it would affect, obviously, you know, this plan. It's a closed plan. There's very few participants left in the plan. About half of the participants in the plan are in the IBEW. So to carve those guys out and have another tier in the my time brain is just going to ooze out the side that I had right out the year and off before.
Do they have a deadline?
They can tap us any time. It was just effective as of January. Their contract is up next year anyway. You know, so if they don't do anything, you know, we anticipate the question coming back up. But just as a pension board, so you know that, you know, if anything's presented as a courtesy, I will share it with the board, you know, just to kind of have an idea of what's what. But my plan would be, as opposed to, you know, hiring out separate city actuaries and attorneys like the last time, that I would, you know, contract separately with Doug and Lee to just look at it for us, because they're familiar with the plan. And so that we're all on the same page as what this is. At this point, I don't have anything, but I just want to share that it's potentially forthcoming, and we're just going to keep the board abreast of that.
Nothing else?
I'm sorry.
I think you can do it, we'll get right, already.